KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, tomorrow we'll be bringing you complete coverage of the historic event of the inauguration of Barack Obama as President of the United States. And in this Forum Hour, we find out all about the inauguration and look back at past inaugurations, as we also explore how the swearing-in of America's first black president links to the legacy celebrated today of the memory of Martin Luther King. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. There are estimates as high as at least 2 million people for tomorrow's much-anticipated inauguration of America's first black president, Barack Obama. Today is also the day set aside on America's calendar to honor the memory of civil rights leader Martin Luther King, and today is a national holiday celebrating Dr. King's birthday. We thought in this hour we would discuss the spirit and tradition of Martin Luther King and what he dreamed for America and the historic inauguration taking place tomorrow in the nation's capital. And in the course of the hour, we're also going to talk about inaugurations past as well as what might be expected in the inauguration tomorrow. But first, we want to check in with Claiborne Carson, who is director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And welcome, Claiborne Carson.
Good to talk to you, Michael.
Good to have you aboard here. Well, we just heard from Scott Schaefer in the last hour about all the excitement and hope and warm feeling that is going on throughout the Capitol now with millions of people literally there to see. I want to talk with you initially, though, about what's shared in terms of this historic moment and the legacy of Dr. King, because you've talked about this, you've written about it, and a sentence that struck me from your own writing was, and I'm quoting here directly from your work, the extraordinary capacity of both Martin Luther King Jr. and Barack Obama for transforming historical insights into prophetic leadership. That kind of sums it up for me in many ways.
Yes, it's very interesting to be here. Later this afternoon, I'm going to go over to the Lincoln Memorial where I was in 1963 as a 19-year-old and just spend a few minutes just contemplating all the changes that have occurred. At that time, Barack Obama was 2 years old. And we were, even though we were 250,000 strong, we were just pleading for the people at the other end of the mall at Capitol Hill to pass a civil rights bill. And that gulf, that physical gulf between the Lincoln Memorial and the Capitol was so large back in 1963. It would have been difficult to imagine what I'll see tomorrow when I am at the other end of the mall and watch Barack Obama take office as the 44th president and just all the other things that were just unimaginable back in 1963 so many of them have been realized in the intervening 45 years.
It is, in many ways, the realization of a dream, of Dr. King's dream, when he talked about people being judged by the content of their character.
Yes, exactly. And one of the questions I have been asked a lot in the last few days is just what would Martin Luther King think? And of course he would be pleased that aspect of his dream had been fulfilled. And, but I think that he would also say that the most important day is not tomorrow, but Wednesday. What are we going to do on Wednesday morning for people who both support and are inspired by Barack Obama, but have a vision close to King's vision? What are we going to do about his idea of continuing the war in Afghanistan? What are we going to do about his plans for the stimulus and what is that difference going to make for poor Americans? So all of these questions will still come up on Wednesday morning, but tomorrow we just celebrate the enormous changes that have occurred in 45 years. And so much of what I like about Barack Obama is that he was inspired by King, and you can see that in his oratory. You can see the way in which he and King both understood that the central question of American history was how do you build a democracy out of a diverse society, multiracial, multicultural society. That's an experiment, and we're still in that experiment. And I think that both of them realize that it's going to be a difficult challenge to build, you know, what Barack Obama refers to as a more perfect union. And so I think that, to me, the excitement is going to be both on Tuesday and on Wednesday. I really want to see how this unfolds over the next 4 to 8 years, and it's going to be exciting to see someone inspired by Dr. King actually governing. And you know, one of the things that Martin Luther King often talked about was that you know, how do you transform conscience into power? How do you usually power consciences without power? And now we have a chance to I think if we treat this Wednesday correctly, we will be changed on Wednesday. We will be hopefully more engaged as citizens in terms of making it possible for Barack Obama to bring about the changes that I think in his heart he really wants to bring about.
Claiborne Carson, with us from Washington, directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford. You spoke a moment ago about how President-elect Obama has acknowledged himself the influence of Dr. King, and there are analogies that are often made in terms of their eloquence, in terms of their oratorical skills, their ability to inspire, the charisma that they both have. I mean, as one of our foremost experts on Dr. King, you see a lot of that, I presume.
Yes, and you see the differences. You see the fact that King was raised in the church and he was inspired by that prophetic tradition. Barack Obama is an inspiring politician, and I think that there is a difference between the prophet and the politician, and we will see that difference worked out.
But it was Reverend Wright who said he was a politician, too. I mean, one can trace the influence of Reverend Wright on Barack Obama, and also a kind of, or can one trace it? I mean, there's often a distinction between Martin Luther King's legacy and Malcolm X's legacy, and I think perhaps even though Jesse Jackson was a follower of Martin Luther King's and an acolyte of his, he also embodied a lot of the ideas of Malcolm X. How much do we see Malcolm X as opposed to Martin Luther King in Barack Obama?
I think that he was inspired by that entire tradition. And in his autobiography, he talks about the way in which his mother would expose him to the speeches of Dr. King and how, like many young African-Americans growing up, of course he was inspired by the autobiography of Malcolm X. So he sees both the optimistic side of African-American oratory, the side that has always said to America, here are your ideals. Don't be hypocrites. Live up to those ideals. So the challenge of a Frederick Douglass or a Martin Luther King. And then there's the other side of the Malcolm X side that says to African Americans, don't wait on white Americans to live up to their ideals. They won't do it. So you see that pessimism. And I think that with Barack Obama, obviously the optimism, the notion that he wants to stand in that tradition that looks back to Lincoln and to Jefferson and to the founders, the same message that King gave here in Washington in 1963, that is, when he talked about the architects of the Republic making a promissory note that they had promised these ideals of you know, liberty and justice and you know, all of the things that are in the Declaration of Independence. And now it was our job as African Americans to make the nation live up to those ideals. Well, I think that Barack Obama in some ways is in that same, caring about that same task of trying to say, here is a nation that has a possibility of democracy. Before 1965, with the Voting Rights Act, I don't even think we were that close to being a democracy. But democracy is an ideal, and we have that possibility of showing the world that you can have cultural and racial diversity and still have democracy.
Claire Bon Carson, again with us from Washington, directs the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford. And Claire Bon, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Forum.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate very much your being with us. And I might add as a coda that Barack Obama delivered his August speech the same day, many of you may remember, as the March on Washington. We're going to preview some of the inauguration tomorrow and talk about inaugurations past and present. Here with us in studio is Joe Tooman, who's professor of political and legal communication with San Francisco State University, author of a recent book, Political Communication and American Campaigns. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Ronald C. White, who is a fellow at the Huntington Library and a visiting professor of history at UCLA. His most recent book is Lincoln, a biography. His other books include Lincoln's Greatest Speech, The Second Inaugural. And welcome, Ronald White.
Thank you. Good to be with you this morning.
Good to have you with us this morning. And we wanted to get you a little into an inaugural mood here before we talk to Professors Tooman and White. So here are some clips from past addresses, some brief clips from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan in their inaugurals.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Well, there are some recognizable, probably to most people, excerpts of some of the more memorable lines from inaugural addresses. Joe Tooman, it's important in these inaugural addresses not so much to lay things out like a state of the, a union address or anything, but really after a divisive campaign to say, this is what we're going to do and what we're going to look forward to in this nation.
I think so. And actually, in the book that you mentioned, one of the things I wrote about, I actually included this in my typology of campaign speeches. And people said, why would you include an inaugural address as a campaign speech? And my thinking on that is this. The inaugural address, especially for the first term of a newly elected official, is it's the first speech you give, obviously, in that new position. But it's also the last opportunity you have to extend and perhaps correct, if you want, the rhetoric of your campaign so that you bring it into clearer focus. You're still flying, as the speechwriters would say, at 50,000 feet. You're right. There's not a lot of detail in these speeches. It's still big generalities. But generally what you do is you transition from the rhetorical themes of your campaign rhetoric into talking now about what the rhetoric of your governance is going to be. So, for example, when FDR gave the speech that we heard the clip from, remember that this was in a time when the United States was in economic peril and people were, maybe like today, very much feeling insecure and vulnerable. And he spoke directly to that and spoke with a theme about having courage and also having hope in the possibility of government. I think you're going to hear, by the way, a little bit of that tomorrow. When we listened to the clip from President Kennedy's speech, it was about the idealism of the period, but it was also about the idea that people needed to be a partner with government and to volunteer and to give service. And interestingly enough, you'll probably hear some of that. You've already heard that this weekend from Barack Obama as well. And that's, again, extending some of the rhetoric of Kennedy's campaign because he was aware of his youth, obviously enough, and he wanted to represent sort of some different idealism. And even with Ronald Reagan, who actually, for me, is a better fit for Barack Obama. I know your listeners will cringe when they hear me say that, but let's remember the times. Reagan came into office when we were in a very serious, I suppose, kind of psychological crisis in this country. Our image abroad was shattered. Does that sound familiar? And there was a sense of malaise around Jimmy Carter's government. Jimmy Carter was a good man, but I think he was seen
thinking long
bad
gas lines and all that sort of
all
thing.
That
and
stuff.
Suddenly Reagan came and said, a new dawn for America.
New
right?
dawn. And what Reagan did was he talked about hope. And he gave people hope. He made people feel good about him. That was in his campaign advertising. That was also what he talked about in his speech. But he said, a lot of this has to come from you. Government won't be the solution to your problems. Now, I don't think you're going to hear Barack Obama say that part tomorrow. But the business about hope, again, which is sort of an extension of what people felt good about Ronald Reagan. You saw that after he died, how many people, even his enemies, turned out to say, we like this guy on a personal level. Barack Obama ran on change and on hope. I mean, those were the broad campaign themes today in this year.
I call it the audacity of hope, getting back to rhetorical influences.
Absolutely.
On him, which came from Reverend Wright again.
Yeah, and I think that everybody would say they felt good about this person. There was something special about him. Reagan was the same way. And all of these presidents that I've just mentioned extended that, if you like, those themes or that kind of rhetoric from the campaign into their governance. And the vehicle for that was the inaugural address. So that's what I think you'll see. I think that's traditionally the way that it's worked well.
And the inaugural address generally fulfills what for the national psyche? I mean, all the trappings, all the rituals. This is, in fact, the most open and extensive one in history and the most expensive, I ought to add. So.
It's a giant party in the middle of a crisis. Yeah.
So it makes us feel good about our national destiny and about who we are and what we are?
Yeah, I think so. And one last...
It sets a tone.
One last thing about that. I think an underlying theme of this campaign, even though foreign affairs eventually drifted away, was a growing sense. I heard this in my work with CBS a lot when we talked to voters. They were very bothered by the way that America was seen in other parts of the world. And they were reassured with Barack Obama that we would perhaps be seen differently, not because he's a Democrat and the other guy was a Republican, but because he was just so very different from what we had had before, and that maybe people would sort of look at in the other parts of the world at the United States differently again and make us feel better about ourselves in the process.
Joe Tooman again is professor of political and legal communication at San Francisco State and the author of Political Communication in American Campaigns. And Ronald C. White is a fellow at the Huntington Library and visiting professor of history at UCLA. His most recent book is A. Lincoln, a Biography. And his other books include Lincoln's Greatest Speech, the Second Inaugural. And that's what I want to talk to you about initially, Professor White, is what you call Lincoln's Greatest Speech. Most people think, of course, about Gettysburg. And yet the Second Inaugural, which was only 7 minutes, is still kind of in many ways, even though we heard cuts from the 20th century, the gold standard for these kind of speeches.
It is the gold standard, but it's very different, even as Joe has just been describing it. Many inaugural addresses are, I'm afraid to say, rather self-congratulatory, both of the American people and of the speaker himself. Second inaugurals really fall into this trap in a very immodest way. You'll all want to know, Jefferson said, that you congratulate me on all the jobs that I did in my first term. Lincoln alone said to the people, and Carter did this in some of his terms, and Reagan beat him up for it, there's a problem that we have in the American ecology, and the problem is what he called the American offense of slavery. So I'm interested to know, and I think he will do this, to what extent Obama will, in a sense, tell us we have a lot of problems to face. He's been doing this, and don't expect a quick solution. So inaugural addresses don't usually do that. The question will be whether he will really allow that to be part of his address tomorrow.
Well, President Lincoln's address was about 7 minutes, and I suppose it shows maybe that less is more. But it was also not only a political speech, it was also infused with a religious or theological perspective. Are we apt to see that, do you think, with President-elect Obama, or should we be seeing that?
Well, Lincoln's speech was surprising in that regard. One newspaper said the next day, he has crossed the line between church and state. Where have we heard that before? If you read The Audacity of Hope, one of the versions of parallelism between Lincoln and Obama that has not been mentioned is this whole question of faith. Obama has a tremendous chapter on faith in The Audacity of Hope. Yes, he doesn't come out of the black church in the sense that Martin Luther King does, but I think he does tap into that heritage, and I do expect him to raise the question of faith. He has already said that he will say at the end of his oath, "So help me God," which is not part of the official language. He speaks of the Bible and the Audacity of Hope as the living word, capitalizing both words. It'll be interesting to see how he does bring this forth. He doesn't use the Bible, though, obviously, in the same way that Martin Luther King did. Will he do so tomorrow will be an interesting question.
Well, another thing that you've pointed out that I think listeners ought to be aware of is how, I mean, we've talked about Obama's oratorical skills, and they're undeniable. You know, he's really a gifted speaker. He's also a speaker who speaks well, more for the ear, for a kind of a poetic sense, an uplifting sort of rhetorical quality. I mean, now we have speeches that are written more for the eye than the ear, aren't we?
They are. I would argue that the inauguration really is an anachronism. It was convened in an earlier century, and that modern politicians don't know what to do with it. John F. Kennedy was an exception. Ronald Reagan was an exception. But most politicians are not trained or gifted to be orators. You tune in on Congress on C-SPAN, and they're speaking to an empty chamber, totally unlike the 19th century. So I argue that there's a difference between speaking and writing, and that Lincoln understood the sound of words. The way he wrote was to speak or whisper a word out loud before he put pen to paper. I think Obama has the same sense of the sound of words. So although we can read it the next day in the newspaper, I think there'll be a very different experience of listening to it tomorrow.
And that's, again, something that, again, ties to the tradition of Reverend Martin Luther King. I mean, that African-American rhetorical style of oratory.
Yes, and King, of course, brings in, you had your previous visitor, Claiborne Carson. King was wonderful at bringing in both the civic resources of this nation and the religious. He would have called it the Judeo-Christian tradition, appealing to both and having a sense, again, for the ear as well as the eye.
So, Joe Tooman, what's your expectation tomorrow? You said, for example, there's going to be an emphasis on values, probably on service, on things of that sort that have been themes of the Obama campaign. What else can we expect?
Well, I think that again, speaking just in generalities, I don't anticipate anything more specific than that tomorrow. A continuation, or if you like, I call it a correction, sort of a polishing of what he'll take out of what he used in the campaign to sort of transition to governance. I do think, actually, he's indicated over the weekend in some comments that he made that he'll do this, that he'll actually sort of flip the point that we were just making with Ronald Reagan before in that soundbite where he says, government's not the solution, government's the problem. And I think actually Obama's going to ask people to trust in smart government, trust that government can be there for you. And this will be code, if you like, or a way of transitioning in the coming weeks to some of the things that we've just mentioned with stimulus package or other things like that.
But doing it in a lofty and uplifting
in
way.
In a lofty and uplifting way. One of the things that you hear when you talk to voters, let me just give a quick anecdote on this. I met with some people last week, and one of the gentlemen I talked to, we were moving a friend out of our house, and this fellow I talked to is also biracial, African-American and Japanese, Republican, by the way, kind of conservative, didn't pay attention to politics for a long time, worked in business. And he said, I suddenly became a junkie in the last 6 months. And I said, is it because of your biracial identity? He said, no, it's because all my life I've saved. I had a college plan for my kids. My wife and I maxed out the 401k. I paid my taxes. And within a few weeks, half of what we'd saved was gone. And he said, for the first time in my life, I'm scared. And I hear that a lot from people. They're frightened. And he said, I'm a little angry that the government does so much for everybody else around the world or for financial investors that got us into this problem, banks, whatever. And what are they going to do for me? And here was a conservative who was saying, who doesn't like the idea of government in your life necessarily, saying, I want someone to help me. I think that Obama spoke to those people in the tail end of the election. He didn't anticipate this crisis was going to happen, but that was an additional part of the win that pushed him through.
It'd be reassuring people then about the role of government, but at the same time, of course, he's put out caveats, so you're going to have to wait a few years before we're going to see
And I think people get that, yeah.
I'm going to open the phone lines. What are you expecting the inauguration tomorrow, and what do you remember historically about inaugurations? And is it as Ronald White said, sort of anachronistic? And what about all the expense and all the hoopla and all the pomp and circumstance? Your thoughts about inauguration, but also what would you like to hear tomorrow in terms of setting a tone from President-elect Obama? Our toll-free number is available to you. Please join us, 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, the number available to you now, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're previewing Tuesday's inauguration of President-elect Barack Obama this hour with Ronald C. White, who is a fellow at the Huntington Library and visiting professor of history at UCLA, and who is the author of A. Lincoln, a biography, and also Lincoln's Greatest Speech, the Second Inaugural. Joseph Tooman, also with us, professor of political and legal communication at San Francisco State, author of the recent book Political Communication in American Campaigns. And we spoke earlier with Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford, trying to certainly see what many people have been pointing out are the connections on this day, honoring the memory of Dr. King and the anticipated sense of, well, what we expect will be at least a high-flight oratory tomorrow from Barack Obama. In fact, asking the question of you, our listeners, what you hope and what you expect in terms of the inaugurative speech. Belva Davis is in Washington. Belva Davis is, of course, the host of This Week in Northern California, which is broadcast on KQED-TV, and a veteran reporter and one of the star journalists of the Bay Area. And good morning, Belva.
Well, gee, Michael, I don't know if I should be on this program. It seems like it's operating at a very high level. I'm down here with the regular folks.
Well, that's...
So we are one people who are standing on a two-hour line to get into the Rayburn House building where you can pick up tickets for the inaugural for tomorrow. And it's a pretty scary place.
Scary because of just the numbers or...
The numbers and the anxiety, and everybody's excited, and you know, some people will. Yesterday, I stood on a similar line to get into the Lincoln Memorial, and a few people started to step out of line and crash the line, and the Secret Service closed it down, and people had waited for 2 hours and could not get in. So everybody is afraid that will happen here today, but let's hope not. But it is interesting. Being in a crowd of the size of people who are just getting to know one another.
What's your sense, just as an observer, about the security? Because it's more extensive and more stringent. I mean, there are over 20,000 police, and there's the National Guard troops and plainclothes agents from over 50 agencies. In fact, one of my friends in Washington said, who's lived there all his life, said, the city is under lockdown.
Well, you know, but I think just as a person here, I must say that I'm not bothered by that. I would rather see more security than less because all of us want to see this be a successful inaugural ceremony. And so, yes, there's security every place. When we were walking around the Capitol, about every 5 feet, I think, went in uniform. Yesterday, around the Lincoln Memorial, along the line, we had the military, you know, with the little military backpacks with the antennas on. They're a little scary. There was a young man who was near me. I was down by the White House, and he couldn't see the White House through the trees, and he said to the guard, "Can I walk through there?" And the man responded, "Yeah, if you don't mind being shot." So there's a little humor still, you know, with all the people who are here just trying to bear through it, as Barack Obama has asked people to do.
Well, you've said you're among the humble folk there, and we should mention this is a personal trip for you and a trip that really goes back to your beginnings as a pioneer African-American journalist. And as I said, one of our best and an icon here in the Bay Area. What is it like for you personally feeling, after all that you've been through, all the civil rights struggles and all that you've covered, to see something like this?
I feel absolutely fortunate to have lived this long, to have had these experiences, to feel that whatever it took was worth it, because this is a glorious moment for so many people, Michael. And I might have said it to you or to your producer, it's also a personal moment for me. My children and I are wearing what we call ancestral pins. We bought our relatives with us, and we're trying to wear them on the tops of our caps so that they can see and feel and observe. We're from Louisiana, you know, this whole experience. So it's quite personal.
You're bringing the Bayou sensibility there.
Yes.
Well, enjoy it. Your spirit is infectious. Obviously, you're really up for this. It's glad to hear. It's good to hear.
Okay, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for Bye-bye. Joining us. That's Belva Davis, who, of course, is host of This Week in Northern California on KQED-TV. And we're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. I wanted to, not to strike a sour note or anything, but Ronald White, I was reading a presidential historian, Robert Dalek, whom I know you know, whose work you know, and he was talking about the danger of such a huge celebration being profligate. I mean, particularly with the stagecraft that we saw in Denver, a lot of criticism of that with the Greek columns and the like. And there is more money being spent on this inauguration. Of course, there are more people than any other inauguration, but more money being spent twice as much as the Bush inauguration or the Clinton inauguration.
Well, and it's such a difficult time in the nation's life
And yet, I think there is a time to feast and a time to fast. And I think this is a feasting time. And I think most Americans understand that. And for African Americans, for all of us, really, this is a single moment in our history. And therefore, I think we're willing to say, this is the time to celebrate. Let's do it. And then we'll roll up our sleeves and get to work.
Again, on Wednesday. And your calls again are welcome. By the way, if you'd like to join us here and discuss the inauguration, inaugurations past or present, or what you hope tomorrow for the future in the speech that's going to be delivered by President-elect Obama, we welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or SiriusXM. And you can also send an email to forum@kqed.org. Richard, good morning. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Michael, and thank you for this program. Wonderful. And I wanted to just make a comment that the gentleman, and I don't know his name, I'm afraid, the gentleman who made the comment earlier, I'm hearing this over and over again, which is why I feel so strongly about it, about Barack Obama's position. And I understand not his practice, but his position probably being closer to Reagan in history than others. So please don't think it's that I'm likening him too much. I understand that's not what you were saying, but I did want to point out that the practice of Reagan was the exact opposite of his rhetoric and teleprompter perfect delivery, and he was always talking the proper thing, help the less fortunate, etc. But then, however, we saw the practice was polar opposite to what was what I saw and experienced firsthand with the largest increase in homeless population in Los Angeles, where I was at the time, and the national debt. Barack talks about the same things, but they come from a place of implied and, imbibed sincerity. And the reason is his story is completely different. His skin color is different. His the route that he wants to take is different. And I want to place some distance in our conscious as we are remembering past presidents and what they've said to this man who has said so many wonderful things but has already been in practice of these things in his life and brings that sincerity forward.
Well, I thank you for making that point. I have to say, though, Joe Tooman, I don't want to speak for you here, but I think what you were trying to communicate was the importance of hope when Reagan stepped up and delivered his inaugural address and trying to create a kind of new spirit in terms of American attitudes, and that's precisely what we're presumably going to see tomorrow.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing that actually I'll agree with your listener. I think that a large number of Reagan's policy. You know, look, the first thing he did when he campaigned, he actually was the first Republican in years to go. If you remember back in 1980, he actually Reagan went to unions and gave speeches and said, "I'm just like you. I was the president of a union. I walked the picket line." He was talking about the Screen Actors Guild. He didn't really have anything in common with those people. And then, of course, once he was elected, he said he was going to be a labor president. This first act was to bust the PATCO, the Air Traffic Controller Union. So, yes, of course, the words didn't always match the deeds on that. But the larger point that I was making, as you said, was that he was someone whose theme in the campaign was about a hope for sort of a new tomorrow, the shining hill in the city. The shining city on the hill. He talked about, and he also traded on the fact that he was personally very likable, and those parts, I think, are similar to Obama. Obama is a very likable person, charismatic. People really, really like him. The worst criticism that people threw at him, whether it was Hillary Clinton or John McCain or Rush Limbaugh, was nice flowery rhetoric, a nice guy, but can he govern? I mean, that was the worst that they could say about him because people like him a lot. And Reagan
in fact,
was
it was Senator Biden who said, I don't believe he's really prepared to govern and be president during the campaign when they were running against one another for the nomination. But Ronald White, comparisons to Reagan notwithstanding, or parallels on this day that we honor Martin Luther King to Reverend King and particularly his oratorical styles and so forth, there are a lot of those who are making analogies to Lincoln. Your thoughts?
Well, picking up on the last comment, flowery rhetoric, I think we've come to distrust words in our society. There's a kind of a modern shibboleth, it's only words. And if you follow that up, you might say, as opposed to actions. I think Lincoln fiercely believed in words. And one of my hopes in talking about Lincoln is that we might begin to believe in words again, and that words are actions. So when Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg, or he spoke words of reconciliation, forgiveness in the second inaugural, these were words of action. Lincoln understood as he grew in the presidency, and I argue that he had to teach himself to be president, his rhetoric changed dramatically. The first inaugural was 25 to 30 minutes long. It was almost the rhetoric of a lawyer crafting a very complex legal argument, and if he made his case, the South would somehow believe it. By the time we move four years forward, he's light years removed from that. He's speaking in much more imaginative, evocative language. And I fully expect Obama, who is already a fine orator, to grow into the presidency, and to watch his oratory grow, I think will be a fascinating experience.
And Lisa joins us. Morning, Lisa.
Yeah, hi there. I loved when Obama addressed the issue of the need to heal the planet in his acceptance speech, and I hope tomorrow that we can expect very strong commitment, particularly around issues that confront my young kids and his young kids, the issue of climate change. And I guess I'm wondering if the guests have anything to say about what they believe to be the prospect of that. But, I mean, I'm hoping for a strong agreement in Copenhagen and strong national legislation in 2009 or 2010.
Well, what do you think, Joe Tooman? You want to go on a limb here? If you think we're going to hear about environmental climate change and things of that sort?
I think if to the degree that he runs out a list of things that will be agenda items, if he does that in enumerating those, that'll be one of them. Do I think it'll be the focal point of the address? I don't think so. The stimulus package, by the way, that he has talked about, though, has stuff about green technology in it, which then gets at the question of climate change, and he tries to tie that to the economic issue. But I don't think that's tomorrow's speech. I think that's Wednesday's speech or next week's speech.
And we thank Lisa for her call. I'll go to more calls here in a moment. But Ronald White, here's a listener named Option, also a history professor, who says, I'm waiting to hear Obama say his middle name when he takes the oath on Lincoln's Bible. I think people in the Islamic world will be profoundly moved by that. I hope he takes the opportunity to speak to the world. What about the middle name of Barack Obama? Some thoughts? It's Hussein, by the way, for those who don't.
It's Hussein, yes. I've heard that he will use his middle name. Who knows whether he will. Obviously, part of what he will do tomorrow in his inaugural address is what Lincoln did so well, and that is it'll be an inclusive address. Lincoln used the words all and both over and over again, and Obama has a wonderful way of being inclusive. It won't be simply about African Americans tomorrow. He will name Native Americans, Asians, Hispanics, and over again, this inclusivity, I think, will be an underlying theme of his address.
And you know, that also ties in with Martin Luther King. It's hard to escape on this day that we celebrate Martin Luther King's legacy and contributions, because in the Ebenezer Church speech that Reverend Martin Luther King delivered, he talked about inclusiveness and racial integration and became a kind of trans-racial political leader in many respects.
Well, in the beloved community, this was the image that he lifted up, and I think, yes, very much so.
You were going to say something here, Joe Tooman?
Well, I would. I'll offer a different perspective, and I hope that I'm mistaken about this. One of the things that was a little bit of a disappointment to me, not just with Obama, both parties, but I would have expected Obama to be better about this, but he was trying to win an election, was the distance he placed between himself, his campaign, and the Islamic community for Muslim Americans, whether it was not having people in the background of a photo or not being more public when he said, I'm not a Muslim, and not adding, I shouldn't have to apologize for being a Muslim. It's not a crime to be a Muslim. Muslims are good people too. And there wasn't that last part of my sentence often enough in his rhetoric. And the reason for that was he didn't want to have that baggage become the substance of negative ads towards the end of the campaign. But frankly, someone who's going to be inclusive needs to be inclusive of everyone. And those people voted for him, I think they were quiet, just like people in the gay and lesbian community voted for him, I think, by and large as well, even though he took a position on gay marriage that wasn't simpatico necessarily with theirs. And I think they're hoping as well that perhaps his choice of one of the people to give one of the prayers tomorrow is a nod towards them. But I think there are other groups that were sort of not as involved in the campaign as they could have been. I've just mentioned two.
Did he chastise members of his campaign who tried to keep Muslims out of the picture? I mean, he did say
they, they said they explained it away as it was blamed off on somebody else.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing as coming out, like I said, and saying, I'm not going to apologize for my middle name. There's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. Let's stop talking about this as if, because the more he had to deny that he was a Muslim, sort of privileged the question that you should have to explain that in the first place. And that's the part, I think, that's as bad, frankly, as when they went after Mitt Romney for being
Mormon.
And no one said, you know, in a free country with free religion, you shouldn't have to apologize for your religious beliefs.
Well, Obama had to dissociate himself not only from association as being a Muslim, but also with Reverend Wright. So he had a couple of faiths that he had to deal with. But let me go to more of your calls in the meantime. Diamond Dave, morning.
Hey, good Martin, Michael, and everybody, as I say every year. This year I'm saying really good Martin. You know, I was there in 1963, standing there. In fact, I was standing there at that Lincoln Memorial as Martin spoke when he said, I have a dream. And it just happened I was standing next to a kid from Antioch. I was talking to him. It turned out to be Joshua Heifetz's son, the violinist's son. And to see Sunday, to see at that memorial, to see Pete Seeger, and I was realizing then that back in 1963, I was there with an overwhelmingly black crowd, hundreds of thousands of black people from all of the South and the country, and just the beginnings of the new left. And to look at Pete Seeger and with those red diaper babies and the young and the beginning of the new left, and seeing Pete Seeger up there really brought it home to me. And looking at that audience and realizing the difference in that audience. I remember the Kennedy, I saw on black and white TV, an overwhelmingly white audience. And now looking Sunday, and seeing people of every color, and Pete Seeger up there, it all came together. And that's why I say, hey, Michael, hey, everybody, it's a really good Martin that we have ahead.
Thank you, Diamond Dave. That's a cultural hero to many, Dave Whitaker, part of the Beat Poetry movement, has his roots here in San Francisco. Speaking about roots, Joe Tooman, you know, the lineage of, we've been talking about Martin Luther King, but the whole idea of this diversity that you were talking about and casting it in a different light with respect to inclusion, but Jesse Jackson deserves some props here, really. I mean, in the sense that he was the first one to talk about rainbows and to talk about things like that. And he was, of course, a follower of Dr. King's. Yeah.
Well, I think that one of the things that Reverend Jackson understood was that the civil rights movement was not just about African Americans. It was there were larger principles in play here. Because if you treat any of us unequally, then you create the possibility of treating everyone unequally. And that, I think, was the wonderful – we talked before about the power of words. And Rainbow Coalition, that word rainbow meant a lot of things. It made it not a black and white thing. It made it a variety. It was more inclusive.
And then the gay movement adopted the rainbow too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it was inclusive in another sense. Professor White, Ronald White, generally, though, you were talking before about how inauguration speeches aren't quite what they – well, they're anachronistic, but they're not what they used to be. And in a sense, there's this tremendous expectation, again, that we're going to find this soaring rhetoric or hear it from Barack Obama tomorrow. It really puts quite an onus on him, doesn't it?
It does. I think he can respond and deliver. This is his medium. He knows how to do this. He understands the sound of words. He understands the silence. I don't expect him to give nearly as long an inaugural address as, say, Bill Clinton or even Ronald Reagan. I think he will seize this moment and do very, very well.
Well, let me hear from more of our listeners. Anne, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to go back to you were asking about the cost of the inauguration and how it compares to Bush and Clinton, and that this is so much more. And I'm actually watching something on NBC right now, which is talking about it's the inauguration committee. They've been interviewing them and talking about who is paying for what. And one of the comment I originally wanted to make was that many of us have made donations. Much of this money is coming from donations. I myself made one, and many of my friends made one. And I think when you have just 2 million people showing up there to see it, you've got all those people possibly making contributions. And not only that, but the security issues for 2 million people have got to be astronomical. I mean, they were just now talking about that, the cost of the extra security, but also the cost of extra transport. So it isn't.
I think people don't realize how many snipers they have and jets and Coast Guard, chemical and biological and radiological detectors. I mean, this is extraordinarily extensive.
And I guess I just want to close with saying that it's so wonderful to see so many people in our Capitol. And I've had it on TV for 2 days. I'm just thrilled with it all, and just to see all the excitement and everybody pouring in, and just it's just a phenomenal thing. And I think the cost of it is, yeah, it's a lot, but I think the cost to not have it might be more.
Well, thank you for those comments, Anne. Do you want to say something about cost here, Joe Tooman? Because some are saying in these tough times, maybe money shouldn't be so freely spent.
I did research this, actually, because it was another news story I was involved with that asked the same questions. My understanding, by the way, the $150 million figure that we keep throwing around like we know what we're talking about is just an estimate. And I don't know if that's an accurate number or not, but it was based on a composite of things. $45 million of this 150 total has been raised in private donations. So that takes us down to a little over $100 million that's coming from somewhere else. About half of that is being paid by the federal government. Some of that goes to pay for the extensive Secret Service protection over time. Some of it has to go to the state of Virginia or to the D.C., actually, and for all the police protection that they're providing, District of Columbia. And then there's a fair amount of it that's also going out of that federal budget for the cleanup, because 3 million, 2 million people, whatever it's going to be, make a lot of litter when they're in the nation's capital. Some of the other parts of the money, my understanding, are coming from some of the surrounding states, like Virginia as well, kicking in as well. So that's how you get to the $150 million. But, you know,
D.C. has to take out of its own coffers, too. I mean,
Yeah. But lost in this discussion is the fact that 3 million people in that area will also have a tremendous economic multiplier effect, because they have to stay somewhere, they have to eat somewhere, they're buying souvenirs from people. I mean, it's probably also a little bit of an economic shot in the arm, and we haven't really focused on that.
Yeah, no, good point. Let me get to some more calls in the meantime. And I'm sorry, David is joining us from Redwood City. Hi, David.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, basically, I wanted to make a comment regarding first comment. You know, as an international student, me having to take American politics class 2 years ago, I remember doing a current event that had to do with the Federalist Papers. And I remember when Obama came on Illinois and he announced he was going to run for president. And my current event was regarding that. And I remember just telling my paper, well, you know, you have a constitution, you have the Bill of Rights, and you have something that says that no matter who you are, where you're coming from, or your color of skin, you can run for president. And of course, my conclusion was, you know, this guy is good, but, you know, my forecast was like, you know, he's not even going to go after, you know, he was going to go past the topics. So, for me, it was impressive. Now, the comment I want to make is, my friend just came back from Brazil yesterday, and she was telling me a story that really struck me. In Brazil, black people are somehow, you know, it's a little bit, they undermine black people on a bigger level than they do here in the United States. They call him black, Negro, all those kind of questions. And one friend of the family, she was telling me how the mom was calling him, hey, you guys are good for nothing. You can do nothing. I mean, you're killing them all the time. And she was making that comment to him when he said, what are you talking about? The new president of the United States is black. And she said that everyone stopped. And everyone, and she just told me it was a moment for her that just changed everything.
I'm sorry, David, we're having a bad connection here. So, but I want to cut to the chase of what I think is the gist of your call, and that is, you know, the role of race in all this again. Joe Tooman?
Yeah, it's not really the subtext of this election. It's out there front forward. But interestingly enough, and let me tie this back to Dr. King, who we began this program with, this race for the presidency has been about so much more than Barack Obama's race, even though it's obviously an important component of the question of change and hope. Barack Obama is also an exceptional individual, and he is very much charismatic, like a Martin Luther King. And they share one other trait, I think, that we haven't talked about in their speaking style and in their decision-making style that's very obvious in a public forum, and that is an overwhelming sense of calm. When everything else around them is chaos, they're the people who seem like the calmest, coolest customers at the table. Martin Luther King walk the walk literally and talk the talk. When he spoke with passion, he spoke with conviction, but always with calm. And frankly, but for his example, I don't think Lyndon Johnson eventually would ever have been moved to push that through, the legislation through that he did.
And
Barack Obama is the same
times,
kind of person.
This is a cool customer, Barack Obama.
Yeah, no
come.
Drama Obama.
No drama Obama, right. Ronald White, getting back again to rhetorical style, we're getting some comments coming in on the community section of KQED.org, and here's one that says, I hope our leaders will move away from the mentality of individualism and self-interest to one of community, global and local. The past 8 years have been overwhelmed with what is best for me and not what is best for us. And he goes on to say, I hope President Obama, having a worldview, will make the changes needed to welcome our past enemies into the family of humankind, all interdependent on each other and the environment we live in. Well, it remains to be seen whether there will be welcoming to the enemies, but certainly he's already talked about talking perhaps to Iran and Cuba, and these are things that we'll have to wait and see unfurl. But I was interested in again, rhetorical style and all this. We don't so much have the first person singular in, say, the African-American rhetorical style.
We don't, and we don't have it in Lincoln. If you read all the inaugural addresses, especially second inaugural, but even first inaugural, you will just hear the pronoun I over and over again. You hear it in our recent political campaigns. I say that Lincoln disappeared in his finest addresses. In the Gettysburg Address, he used not one personal pronoun. In the second inaugural, he used only two personal pronouns. He always pointed beyond himself to transformative ideas. And although we have these kind of messianic expectations of Obama or comparisons to Lincoln, I think Obama at his best points beyond himself. That was the remarkable part of the November 4th speech at Grant Park, how understated it was, how really humble it was, and he was pointing to the American people. They brought this about, and I think he will lift up this sense of community. I think this comes out of the African-American community. It comes out of the best of the Christian tradition. It certainly is following in the footsteps of Lincoln.
Well, we're on the cusp of a major historic moment here, and we will, of course, be continuing to cover the inauguration. In fact, the inauguration conversation will continue on our website after the program. Just visit kqed.org and click on community. But right now you can know the fact that we have come to the end of the program, and it's exciting. We will be preempted tomorrow, and you'll hear all about the inauguration live with the coverage that we have there. I want to thank Belva Davis for being with us earlier. Also thank Claiborne Carson, who was with us, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford. Thanks also to Ronald White, fellow at the Huntington Library, author of A. Lincoln Biography, and Joe Tooman, professor of political and legal communication at San Francisco State. His recent book is Political Communication and American Campaigns. And thanks to all of you. We'll be back with you after we have a new president. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.